WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writer's Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In its last term, the Supreme Court dropped one bombshell after another. The new 6-3 conservative majority left John Roberts' more or less incremental approach firmly behind the court. And the court now advanced major conservative positions on gun rights, the separation of church and state, environmental protection, and of course the decision in Dobbs, which overturned Roe v. Wade. The court is not behaving as an institution invested in social stability, our contributor Jeannie Sook-Gerson wrote in July, and that was putting it politely. I wanted to talk with Jeannie now about the court's new term, which just began, and what other bombshells may fall. Jeannie Sook-Gerson is a professor at Harvard Law School, and she was once a clerk herself on the Supreme Court, working for Justice David Souter. Jeannie, of the many cases on the docket for the Supreme Court, what are you watching most closely?
Well, I'm watching most closely the affirmative action cases that the court will hear at the end of this month. And those are cases against Harvard and the University of North Carolina.
I can't help but ask, you're at Harvard.
Yes.
You're at Harvard Law School. It's got to be the talk of the law school. What do people expect will happen with this quite conservative Supreme Court?
I think everyone, whether at Harvard or elsewhere, who's been watching and listening to the court, expects that the court will overrule its precedent. And basically, it will say that affirmative action that uses race as a factor in admissions is unconstitutional and unlawful. And I don't see any reason to hope that it would go the other way.
That'll have tremendous consequences, won't it?
I think yes and no. Will there be other measures that universities can take to try to ensure diversity on their campuses? Of course they can, as long as it's what we would call a race-neutral method. And there are such methods that have been approved by the court.
What's a race-neutral method?
So, for example, in Texas, there was something called the Texas 10% plan that the court did approve as being lawful. Essentially, it takes automatic admission from 10% of the top of each high school. And that's automatic, given that we have residential segregation and school-based segregation in our country in a lot of places. This actually ensures that the student body of the University of Texas will be racially diverse. I think those are the kinds of things that schools are immediately going to be moving to, and probably they're already thinking about it now.
In the redistricting case from North Carolina, Moore versus Harper, the state is basically asking the Supreme Court to enshrine the legislature's power over election law. No state court could challenge an election map. The consequences then are what?
This, I'm not exactly sure what the majority will rule. I have to say I'm uncertain about the result in this case. I mean, this involves the elections clause that says that the manner of federal elections shall be prescribed by each state by the legislature thereof. And so here, the state legislatures had a manner of deciding how the election should be run, and then the state judiciary had a different idea based on its interpretation of the Constitution. The result of the Republican legislature's view is that state legislatures can engage in any kind of gerrymandering or voter suppression without any judicial review by state courts. That would be hugely consequential because it essentially says state legislatures do whatever you want, essentially without being bounded by law. And so I don't think there's a very strong basis to make a prediction in this case, to be honest with you.
I don't mean to do violence to the prose of any of my colleagues, but I think it's fair to say that if you took a summary away from what Amy Davidson Sorkin wrote in The New Yorker this week, is that if you thought that the overturning of Roe v. Wade was a big deal, wait till the Supreme Court goes at it again this season. Do you envision overall consequences coming out of the Supreme Court this fall anywhere near what it was like when Roe v. Wade was overturned?
Well, Roe v. Wade had such a symbolic cultural importance. The cases this term are not going to have that kind of salience culturally, but they really go to very fundamental principles of our country. What is the meaning of having a democracy and what is the meaning of having it be multiracial? What does it mean to actually be able to freely elect one's representatives? These are very, very basic ideas. And then, of course, it goes right back to the affirmative action case as well, because it's about the meaning of the equal protection of the laws and about whether we have to look at things in a colorblind manner or one that actually takes into account that what it takes for the government to ensure equal protection of the laws or a multiracial democracy, the proper functioning of it, that that would mean being conscious of the race of the population and how to make sure that all of the races get to freely elect their representatives. It's all tied up together.
And finally, Jeannie, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about Donald Trump and the Mar-a-Lago documents. Trump has asked the Supreme Court to intervene in that case. What do you think the court will do there, if anything?
That case is a huge mess. I mean, it's just a mess. My prediction is that the Supreme Court will not come out on the side of Donald Trump in this case. It will probably just let it roll in the 11th Circuit and in the district court. That's my guess right now. I would be surprised. I could be wrong, but that would be my guess.
Thanks so much, Jeannie. I know there'll be more to talk about the Supreme Court as the fall evolves. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeannie Sook-Gerson is a professor at Harvard Law School, and you can read her work for us at newyorker.com. The impact of the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision is shaking the balance of power in the United States. This summer, when Kansas voters rallied behind reproductive choice in a referendum, they sent a resounding signal of political defiance. Our writer Peter Slevin, after covering the Kansas referendum, shifted his reporting to the state of Michigan, where there's an initiative on the ballot that would put the right to abortion in the state constitution. And that's shaping this November's race for governor and control of the U.S. Congress. Here's Peter Slevin.
As I was trying to decide where to go in Michigan to focus on the battle over reproductive rights, the 3rd District in western Michigan, centered in Grand Rapids, really caught my eye. It's a district that has long been held by Republicans. This year, Hillary Scolton, a Democrat who lost a race for Congress 2 years ago to a Republican, got back into the race. One thing has changed since Scolton lost 2 years ago. An independent election commission has redistricted. In recent years, voters have elected conservative Republicans. This year, Scolton is given a real shot.
Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for coming out on this Thursday afternoon.
On one warm September afternoon, Scolton's advance team set up shop outside of a brew pub in the backyard. She took the microphone and talked about what was at stake.
I'm running because choice is on the ballot, regardless of what happens with this ballot initiative. It doesn't stop here, right? The extremists in Congress have already shown that they want to take away access to contraceptives.
It was a weekday afternoon, and several dozen people showed up both to listen and to move on out as her organizing force.
For years, we have been held hostage by Republican gerrymandering. But the good people of Michigan have been fighting back. And thanks to our incredible efforts by voters, not politicians, we have a once-in-a-generation election this cycle and the opportunity of a lifetime to elect majorities up and down the ballot. And when it comes to Michigan's third congressional, to send the first Democratic woman in West Michigan history to Congress. I'm ready.
Skolton is running against a man named John Gibbs, a Republican who moved into the district to compete in this race. I reached out to the Gibbs campaign, hoping that he might talk with me. He declined, as did the Michigan Republican Party. He was strongly backed by former President Donald Trump, and this is what he tweeted on the morning of the Dobbs decision. God wins. I wanted to see how other candidates were talking about abortion, so I drove across the state the next day to see Gretchen Whitmer.
Just appreciate you making time. You know, it's such a precarious moment.
She gathered a group of women around a table at a Cajun restaurant. Whitmer herself started by telling her own story.
You know, obviously I'm here as the governor. I'm also here as a woman. I'm here as a mother. I'm also here as a survivor. When I was in college, like one out of four women, I was raped. And in the days in the aftermath, you know, it was devastating. And it didn't hit me right away, but maybe hours or a day into it, I thought, oh my God, what if I'm pregnant? And I knew that if that were the case, that I would have the ability to make my own choice for what was right for me.
One of Whitmer's guests, a physician's assistant named Nikki, says she sees a startling number of young women who are asking for birth control.
They're terrified, and I have women who aren't sexually active asking to go on birth control because of this. I've had so many patients that are choosing IUDs right now, so intrauterine devices that are long-term devices that can, you know, be there between 3 and 10 years, and they're choosing that because they don't know where the future of this conversation is going.
For 45 minutes, it was story after story of women who were worried about what it would mean to lose access to abortion. There were military veterans. There were women who work in healthcare. There was one mother who was there with her daughter. And Whitmer was listening and talking about how essential it is. She called it a precarious moment for the country.
You know, it's such a precarious moment, and this is such a...
After the roundtable, I was able to catch up with the governor for a few minutes.
I think it would be a real mistake to assume everyone understands how dire and serious this moment is, and that's why I think it's crucial that we are communicating and doing roundtables and continuing to put the focus on this, because it's very real and it's very raw. And in Michigan, if we're not successful, you have to go international to get access to abortion care by going to Canada or get all the way to Illinois, which will mean a lot of women will not have access and lives will be lost. And so we can't stop educating.
So what are the anti-abortion forces saying about all of this? I checked in with Michigan Right to Life, which is based, as it happens, in Grand Rapids in Skolton's district, and asked Chris Gast, who's the education coordinator, how they see November and what the Dobbs case has meant to their efforts.
The message for candidates is, look, you know, most of the American public is kind of in the middle on abortion, very confused. They're not sure what they believe. You need to say that you have a consistent position on the value of unborn life, and you need to ask them, now that we have Roe versus Wade gone, the status quo has been abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy for any reason, which is what your opponent in most cases would be supportive of, you know, everything from partial birth abortion, tax-funded abortions, no parental consent for abortions. So by all means, have a frank conversation about what are people's opinion on abortions.
We've certainly read stories. There's one example in Michigan, but there are others elsewhere where Republican candidates who are broadly opposed to abortion are downplaying it because they don't want to get into the debate about whether it should be a full ban or not.
It's common that sometimes in elections, and it's always been the case, that you have to try to get pro-life candidates to really talk about the issue. So that's kind of nothing new. I don't think we've seen a real mass movement away from that. But I think certainly they need to think harder about how they need to talk about it now that it's going to be an issue that people are going to be directly voting on, and they're going to be voting on it in a very meaningful way.
Later that afternoon, I went out door knocking with Hillary Skolton to see what reception she's been getting from voters. She's the Democrat running for Congress in the district anchored in Grand Rapids. On one busy street, she came across a man sitting on his front porch. He introduced himself as John, and right off the bat, he said he had seen Skolton's ad, but he frankly wasn't sure which way he was going to vote.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You have? Yeah. All right. Are you planning to vote in November?
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some of the issues that matter to you? Like some things that really...
The abortion, I think she's wrong.
Yeah?
And yeah. Lo and behold, the first thing he mentioned was abortion.
What is it about abortion that you feel strong?
It should be a woman's freedom to do that themselves.
Yeah, make them...
Make that choice themselves.
Yeah, yep. That's what I believe too. I'm a Christian, I am a mom myself, and I think that it's up to every woman's God-given ability to make that decision for themselves.
They had a lengthy back and forth as cars were going by on this busy street, and at the end, Skolton said, can I count on your vote?
Can I count on your vote in November? Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. All right.
Thank you, sure can.
The other day, you were nice enough to let me tag along as you knocked on doors. It was an upscale neighborhood. It was a neighborhood where Gerald Ford, the former president, had once lived.
Yes.
And I was struck by this couple who answered the door when you knocked, who said, well, we actually used to be Republicans. Mm-hmm. We are no longer Republicans. Did that stand out to you?
Oh, I mean, honestly, not really, because I hear it all the time. It is, you know, I would say it's one of the dominant narratives that we hear here. And, you know, people have, you know, either they used to be Republicans 5 years ago, 10 years ago. We're talking to people who used to be Republicans 2 weeks ago. And, you know, they say the choice on the other side is just not for us, and we want to support you because, you know, you're the right candidate for our district.
What was striking to me was how often Skolton spoke of abortion in terms of her own religion. This is an issue that Republicans, especially and particularly evangelical Christians on the right, have made their own. How does your faith connect with your views on reproductive rights and abortion?
Yeah, well, you know, I feel called to love my neighbor as myself. That includes loving and caring for women and trusting them to make their own reproductive choices for themselves. That is not a role for the government. And, you know, I also deeply believe that my particular views on this and what I would choose for myself are not not appropriate to make laws that reflect one particular view on abortion.
If Skolton wins and she is leading in the polls, it's going to be pretty darn meaningful. It means that the political equation surrounding reproductive rights and specifically abortion has changed and changed dramatically since June when the Supreme Court issued its Dobbs decision. It will mean that voters who believe in abortion rights are turning out and are making their voices felt in a way that we simply haven't seen in many, many years.
Peter Slevin is based in Chicago. John Gibbs, the Republican running against Hillary Skolton in Michigan, declined to be interviewed, but in a statement, he called Skolton's position on abortion extremist. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted, From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Tom Stoppard, one of the great playwrights of his generation, is somehow reminiscent of Vladimir Nabokov, a writer who was not born to the English language, but who relishes above all the words that are his instrument and his material. Since the success of his early play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, Stoppard has been celebrated both for his comic genius and the way he plays with ideas in his work. He's 85 years old, and until now, he's largely resisted the autobiographical element in his plays. But now, in Leopoldstadt, he's made that shift. Leopoldstadt deals with a piece of family history that seems like something from fiction. Much of Stoppard's family had been killed in the Holocaust. His mother escaped from Czechoslovakia with him and his brother, and she eventually married a British officer who brought the family to England. Stoppard is mining that history in Leopoldstadt in a way that's both personal and very large in scale, spanning 50 years and featuring a cast of 38 actors, some who play more than one role.
I'm lucky to be a writer. I don't want to stop being a writer. And when I finished Leopoldstadt, I was really glad that there was a possibility that if I did not write another play, I was really glad about the fact that I'd finished on a big thing.
Tom Stoppard spoke with our contributor, Andrew Dixon, just before the play opened on Broadway.
Do you still get those butterflies when you're waiting for an audience to come in? Do you still think about what they're going to think, how they're going to respond?
The answer is that I stopped being nervous a few plays ago. But with this one, I feel, a few butterflies about opening Leopoldstadt here, yeah. When we finish talking, I'll be going back to the Longacre Theatre to sit in the auditorium, which is now absolutely packed with digital boxes of gadgetry and people, which makes you understand that putting on a play on Broadway now it's a heavy-duty thing. It used to be so simple, comparatively simple. I mean, in my youth, we could do an act a day when we were at this stage of the process in technical rehearsal. I'm more nervous than I used to be because just by breathing that atmosphere, you get a sense of how high the stakes must be.
Leopoldstadt, the play itself, is all about time. It's this journey through nearly 60 years of history from 1899 to 1955, the story of one Jewish family over several generations as they're slowly sucked into the horrors of the Holocaust. What made you want to write on that kind of scale? It's such an enormous canvas of time.
Well, the way you put it, it's as though I'd kind of made a decision to write on a particular scale. It was more a case that I was writing without the usual constraints because I was given a kind of carte blanche by Sonia Friedman to write anything I like, and she'd, you know, do everything she could possibly do to get it on. So,
and she's the producer, we should say.
She's the producer of Leopoldstadt, and I knew I wanted to write kind of a bleak version of my family background, and more particularly, I wanted to write about coming to England at the age of 8, and I thought when I set off with the play that the second half would be set in England and would take me through the first 20 years of my life. It didn't work out like that. Plays never do. They find their own architecture and their own story even. So I just went along with what I had and tried to be inventive, and I ended up writing about myself in 1955. So I do get into my own play for the last 20 minutes or so. But that young man's family history is only in the broadest sense like mine. There's enough shared experience, as I found as soon as the play was out there, there's enough shared experience to go around tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of families who all can say, you're writing about my family. Of course, they know I'm not, and I know that I'm not, but it's also true that, yes, I'm writing about their families too.
Because it's, as you say, it has these fascinating autobiographical hints, I guess, if anyone knows anything about your backstory, that, you know, you were evacuated, as it were, to England, or travelled to England when you were 8. You had this very, very English upbringing. And this hidden history, which you only discovered in your 50s, when I think a relative, a cousin of yours, got in touch and said, do you know what happened to your family? And she said, well, you're Jewish. You know, four of your grandparents died in the Holocaust, several of your aunts. There was this whole other history and this side to your family history and to yourself that you hadn't really known about. I mean, is that true? You had just not known it?
Yes, I mean, that does sound pretty awful and weird as well, but I did not know it. I didn't know that my mother's sisters existed. I didn't know what happened to my four grandparents. But at the same time, I could have found out if I'd persisted. And I wasn't a complete idiot. I knew we left Czechoslovakia because of the Jewish problem, or the Nazi problem, depending on where you are. And I'd talked to my mother about that very occasionally. But like my mother, I was just facing forward and getting on with life. Well, you know, when you're 8, 9, 10 years old, whatever, you take what comes. I was at a boarding school in an Indian hill station when I was 5. My father unknowing to me, meanwhile being killed by the Japanese.
Was it also that your mother didn't really want
to? No, she really did not. She married Major Stoppard, bless her. He brought us to England. She didn't want to look back, and she didn't. She never really talked much about the past. I didn't ask many questions. But actually, come to think of it, much later on, I asked her to write down everything she could remember, pretty much. I gave her a very beautiful leather-bound notebook to do it in, which she ignored. But it would be misleading to see me as somebody who blithely and innocently, at the age of 40-something, thought, oh my goodness, I had no idea I was a member of a Jewish family. It's complete nonsense. Of course I knew, but I didn't know who they were. And I didn't feel I had to find out in order to live my own life. But that wasn't really true.
When you were writing Leopoldstadt, are there things that you wish you could have asked her about it, like revisiting that history? Are there questions that have come up?
No, she wouldn't have much liked me writing the play at all, I don't think. Or perhaps by that time it wouldn't matter. I mean, she died in the 90s. Up to that time, especially earlier, she really wouldn't have liked me to write about myself as somebody who's actually Czech and had relatives living in communist Czechoslovakia.
She just didn't want to...
She was scared of communists. She'd been scooped out of the way of Hitler and then out of the way of the Japanese. And I guess when my father was dead and we were still in India, I guess if she hadn't married a British Army officer, we might have gone back home, which wouldn't have been so great.
We're talking about these autobiographical resonances in Leopoldstadt, mm-hmm. the play. You've said in an early version of it, or your original intention was actually to write yourself into the play, and it sounds a little bit like you then kind of wrote yourself out of the play, because what we have right at the end, I think pretty much in the final scene, there is a character who you call Leo. He's an English writer. He writes these funny books. He itself, it turns out, is a refugee. He doesn't know anything about his history, and his Jewish relatives explain it.
No, it's brazen self-pillage. I mean, it is. It's, I mean, there's an element of confessional about it, of course. He speaks for me, and he ends up in tears, with good reason to be in tears. And I don't want to be mawkish on the radio, but I think I can say that they're my tears.
You made the very unwise statement when someone was interviewing about Leopoldstadt, and you said it could be your last play. It made a lot of headlines. Then you said, actually, well, maybe it isn't my last play. That's just how I was feeling at the time. I'm not sure. I guess the question is, you know, how are you feeling now? Are you trying to write another play?
I am. And I really, really very much would like to be working on another play because, well, it comes down to it. I have family to love and be loved by. So it seems not the most tactful thing to say about one's work, but in a way it is one's work which makes one's life purposive. I don't get enough energy out of being a father and a grandfather. I am a writer. I'm lucky to be a writer. I don't want to stop being a writer. And when I finished Leopoldstadt, I was really glad that there was a possibility that if I did not write another play, I was really glad about the fact that I'd finished on a big thing. So it struck me as a good idea to retire at that point, so I would not end up in my twilight years writing miniatures. And I might not yet have escaped that fate, because I'd rather write a miniature than nothing. And it turns out that my last direct and personal experience of writing plays would turn out to be sitting in the Wyndham Theatre in London and then the Longacre Theatre in New York City, sitting in those houses that had been there a long time with all kinds of work on their boards. If it turns out my last direct experience was sitting in an audience watching and listening to Leopoldstadt, that would be a fortunate destiny. I'd consider myself blessed.
I wonder if I could just ask you about one other thing, which is that we're talking fairly soon after the death of the Queen.
Yeah.
Obviously a huge story in all sorts of ways. You met her a number of times, I think. Did you get a sense
right.
of her?
Yes, I have met her a number of times. But the person one has lost, the loss one feels is not the loss of the person one met, but the loss of the office itself, the loss of that person who represented the constitutional monarchy for the whole of my life. I mean, I was, as we keep saying, I was 8 when I got to England. I was a subject of one woman, this one monarch. The loss is real because, well, maybe who knows? I mean, there's all kinds of people out there, and I imagine lots of them hate the very idea of a monarchy. I've loved the monarchy as an abstract idea, and I've also loved the way that this queen, Queen Elizabeth II, comported herself and the way she took the role seriously.
I mean, we say this about actors, don't we? But the Queen really did inhabit that role.
Yes. I mean, the whole point and purpose of a mask is that it doesn't slip. That's what it's for. She's quite aware, or was quite aware, of the effect she had on people who were meeting her for the first time. And, the commonest story there is about people who meet the Queen for the first time is how friendly and informal the experience turned out to be.
And that was your experience as well?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's been a delight to speak, Tom. Thank you so much for the time.
I've enjoyed myself with you, Andy. Thank you very much.
Tom Stoppard's play, Leopoldstadt, is playing on Broadway. You can read more from Andrew Dixon's interview with Stoppard at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Gina Davis was in some of the quirkiest and most interesting films of the 80s, The Fly and Tootsie, and she's certainly best remembered now for Thelma and Louise, which was groundbreaking in its moment, a saga or a buddy movie about the consequences of women striking back against male violence. Gina Davis has now written a memoir about her life on and off the camera, and she spoke with staff writer Michael Shulman, who covers entertainment.
You may not have seen Gina Davis in a movie lately, but you might have caught her at the Emmy Awards last month, where she was honored for her work with the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media. 20 years ago, she was watching TV with her 2-year-old daughter and was shocked to see how few female characters were on screen. She wanted to know how big of a problem this was, so she spearheaded a major research project to gather data on gender representation in children's entertainment. And that's how an Oscar-winning movie star began her new life as what she calls a middle-aged data geek. She would walk into executives' offices armed with numbers, but she wasn't confrontational.
It was polite. It was very polite. My approach was very polite because I said, I know you don't know this. You know, take it, whatever, do whatever you want with it. I just thought, you know, you might like to hear this. And I'm never going to bust you publicly. I'm never going to name a movie or a studio or anything. This is just private between us.
It turns out the politeness is something that Gina Davis has been wrestling with her whole life. And it's one of the subjects of her new memoir, Dying of Politeness. How did you learn politeness and why is it so deadly?
Well, I learned politeness from minute one, I'm sure. I mean, that was my family, you know, very old-fashioned New Englanders, both from Vermont. And, well, it wasn't so much being kind. It was not making anyone go out of their way for you for anything. Never ask for anything, never need anything. But on the other side, offer everything. Like my dad fixed everybody on the street. He fixed their plumbing or their furnace or their car or whatever, you know. It was just in my family.
Right. And when did you realize that there was a kind of downside to politeness?
Well, I mean, it was painful sometimes to say no. You know, if we went to visit friends' houses and they offered me candy, I had to say no. And my best friend's mom was an incredible cook. Oh, she made this chicken with garlic. It was incredible. So anyway, and I'd be smelling that and like, oh, it's time for me to go home for dinner. And she'd say, Gina, do you want to stay? No, no, thank you. And then she'd call my mom and just say, Lucille, Gina's staying for dinner. All right, talk to you later. So she would rescue me from my own politeness.
I want to talk a little bit about your earlier career. You moved to New York in 1978. What was the plan?
Oh, I knew I wanted to be in movies rather than plays. Nobody told me that if you want to be in movies, you should probably go to LA. So my plan was I would become a model and then people would just offer me movies because at that time, Christy Brinkley was showing up in a couple of movies and Lauren Hutton. And I thought, okay, it's so much easier to become a supermodel than an actor. Well, I mean, I must have assumed that, which was crazy.
I have to ask you about this. When you were pursuing your modeling career, you were working on Ann Taylor on Fifth Avenue. And, you know, this is not something that an extremely shy, self-effacing person would necessarily do. But you kind of put on your own version of street theater. Can you just explain what happened?
So I tried to look very nice every day, you know, fully made up and hair done and maybe Ann Taylor clothes even. And one weekend, the window display in the front on the street was a couple of mannequins sitting, but there was one empty chair in between them. And I said to one of my friends, dare me to go in the window and pretend to be a mannequin. And I just sneaked in the window. I sat down. A couple of people had been looking in the window and saw me do this. And then they're like, what's she going to do? And then more people are coming out. What are you guys looking at? Just wait. And then I finally moved, and they were like, ah, and clap.
I mean, what was motivating you?
Just for kicks, see if I could do it. I mean, I didn't intend to make a thing out of it. I was just going to do it that once, but they started hiring me to do that on Saturdays, you know, like 5 hours in the window.
Ultimately, the model to actor plan kind of worked. I mean, you got your first role in Tootsie through modeling, didn't you?
It completely worked. When they were casting Tootsie, the role that I ended up playing needed to be in her underwear in a couple of scenes. And they thought, well, let's just check if there's any models who can act. So they called all the modeling agencies to see. And my agents said, yes, we have one. And so I got to audition. And they said, wear a bathing suit under your clothes. And so I read, it was just with like an assistant casting director and a video camera. I read and she said, okay, thank you. And I left and I was like, well, that's fine. I didn't do well enough. And plus on my first audition ever, you know, what are the odds I'm going to get in a movie with Dustin Hoffman? And so then I went to Paris to do the collections and Cindy Pollack saw my audition tape and said, hey, wait a minute, I like this girl. Where's her bathing suit stuff? They said, oh, we forgot. Get her back. We can't. She's in Paris. And to my great happiness, I had been in a Victoria's Secret catalog. And so they sent the photos from that over there. So as opposed to being, you know, in Midtown Manhattan in some dingy office building, I had perfectly lit, airbrushed, fan-blowing photos of me in underwear already, and I guess that clinched it.
So much of the arc of the book is about how you learned sort of boldness and bravery and assertiveness from your characters. Mm-hmm. What was an early example of that?
Well, yeah. I had to play someone who was so much bolder than myself. Mm. Accidental Tourist was one where she was very confrontational in a way and said what she thought at the moment she thought it and was not going to give up on things, very tenacious, and wasn't going to take no for an answer.
Right.
And so that was really the first time that I had to really step outside myself.
Muriel Pritchett, let me give you my card. Oh, well, I'll bear that in mind. Thank you very much.
Or just call for no reason. Call and talk.
Talk?
Sure. Talk about Edward, his problems. Talk about anything. Pick up the phone and just talk. Don't you ever get the urge to do that?
Not really.
This is your Oscar-winning role as Muriel Pritchett, the dog trainer, opposite William Hurt. And you write about reading the book and immediately wanting to option it yourself.
Right.
I mean, what was it about that character? Was it that sense of wanting to be like her in some way?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, she's so colorful. And I thought, wow, how fun would it be to play this character? Optioning a book, I mean, that wasn't something that was going to happen. But Dustin Hoffman had given me that advice when I was on Tootsie. He said, read a lot of books. And if you see something you like, try to get the rights.
Dustin Hoffman seems to have a lot of advice for you, didn't he?
Yeah, all day long he was giving me advice, yeah.
Because he also told you, if don't sleep with your co-stars, and if they want to say, what was the line?
You want me to tell that story?
Please.
So after Tootsie, my model agent took me and a couple of other actors slash models to Hollywood to meet casting directors. And he happened to know Jack Nicholson. And every single night, Jack Nicholson had dinner with us. And then one day I came back and there was a note under the door that said, please call Jack Nicholson and this number. And I was like, oh, I can't believe it. Jack Nicholson called me? Oh my God. But anyway, I said, hello, Mr. Nicholson. This is Gina, the model. You called me? He said, yeah, hey, Gina, when's it going to happen? And I was like, oh, no. But it immediately came into my head what to say, because I'd been holding on to this advice. So I said, oh, Jack, I would love to. You're very attractive. But I have a feeling we're going to work together at some point in the future, and I would hate to have ruined the sexual tension between us. He was like, oh, man, where'd you get that? So it worked.
So getting back to Accidental Tourist, how did that character kind of rub off on you?
I became much more able to be assertive, more than I was, which was profoundly unassertive.
In a way, that seems like a bit of what happened in Thelma and Louise, which is that the off-screen dynamic between you and Susan Sarandon kind of mirrored how Louise emboldens Thelma.
Absolutely, yeah. I was so in awe and admired Susan Sarandon so much. And to witness that nobody gave a shit if she said what she thought, you know, that, like, she never used qualifiers like, I don't know what people would think, or I don't know, this is probably a stupid idea. And that was my life, was a string of qualifiers before I would say anything. So it was the whole shoot was an education for me in how to very calmly and capably say what you want.
I don't know, Louise. I mean, I don't know what you're asking.
Now, don't you start flaking out. I mean, God damn it, Thelma. Every time we get in trouble, you just get blank or pleading sanity or some such shit. Not this time. I mean, this time, things have changed. Everything's changed.
Now, you, of course, are in these two iconic feminist movies right back to back, Thelma and Louise and League of Their Own. I mean, they were so impactful.
Oh, yeah. So Thelma and Louise exploded onto the scene. Like Susan and I were on the cover of Time magazine a week later or something. So, and the headline was, Why Thelma and Louise Strikes a Nerve. Not why is Thelma and Louise so great.
And then what kind of response do you remember for A League of Their Own?
What I noticed was before it came out, a lot of people came to the set to interview me or us. And during these interviews, it was fascinating because almost every single person, male or female, said, so would you say this is a feminist movie? Kind of in this wink-wink tone, you know, like. And I'd say, yeah, it is. And they'd be like, it is? It is? Are you saying you're a feminist? And I'd say, yeah, sure. They couldn't believe I would say that out loud, which is so crazy. But that's how strong the backlash was at that time.
Well, I want to talk about a period in your career that doesn't get as much attention, which is the right after that. You know, we always hear about women in Hollywood turning 40 and suddenly just not getting roles. But I'd sort of like to hear about how that, what exactly happened from your perspective?
It was just absolutely heartbreaking because this is my thing. It felt like forced retirement or something. The work just literally dried up. It was incredibly painful.
But it also seems to me like this, that period where you were not working as much was fruitful in other ways because you took up other interests. I mean, one of them was archery. Can you describe how you took up an interest in archery?
So I had to learn how to play baseball for League of Their Own. And I was really worried about it because I'd never been athletic. So trained with the coaches that they had, and they very soon said, you have some real untapped athletic ability. And I was like, wow, I do. So then I was determined, I want to take up a sport in the real way and not, you know, a movie version of it. And so I picked archery because I saw it on TV during the Olympics in Atlanta, and then total immersion. And yeah, I was a semifinalist for the Olympic trials 2 years later. It was incredible. I really changed my body image and the idea of how much space I could take up in the world, you know, to become athletic and realize that I don't have to be ashamed of how tall I am and ashamed of my body because I can do cool things. So it was very transformative.
Gina Davis talking with Michael Shulman. Her new memoir is called Dying of Politeness.
Gina, this has been so much fun. Thank you. Thank you again. It's great to talk to you.
You too, Michael. I'm sorry I wasn't sometimes very articulate.
That's still dying of politeness.
Oh my God, you see?
I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow. To get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.